Hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
So you know how I say that you should subscribe to the show? It's because we don't know when these things are going to come out. And so, like, if you're waiting on any kind of thing like that, then you're just going to be waiting because these things come out sporadically, such as right now when you're listening to this, because Trump's getting impeached again tomorrow. So we figure we should talk to you right here on Plastic Up Politics Podcast. Yeah, that's what you're listening to. Welcome to Plastic Up Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD. That PhD is in political science. I have questions. He has answers. I have. I like to know political things. I like to read the news, but I like somebody's take on it. That's why we have Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD. We are your preeminent Arizona drinking and politics podcast. And we will go ahead and tell you at Plastic Cup Pod is the right way to interact with the show. Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, we are recording on February 8th, Monday. The impeachment starts tomorrow. How are you and what are you having?
So I'm doing really well. I'm super excited for ye olde second impeachment to begin. And on Friday, I get my second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. It's the one upside to come out of having kidney cancer. Is that I get to jump the line a little bit in terms of the COVID vaccine. And of course, Jen, because she's a teacher, is getting her second vaccine on Friday too. So the first shot, I literally, other than a sore shoulder, I experienced no ill effects. So when your time comes up, or if you can get on, you know, there's a couple of different lists going around the valley of like injection sites that don't want to throw away doses, and they will call people or text people at the very last minute and say, hey, you know, just drive down here right now. It's first come, first serve. If you can make it here in time, we'll get the needle in your arm. And once you have that first dose, you get scheduled for your second, right? Because they want to make sure you get it. So if you can manage to get one of those doses that might end up getting thrown away otherwise, or when your time comes up, get the vaccine. No ill effects whatsoever for me. Or for Jen, and as Mark knows, my lovely wife, bless her, does not have the most hale and hearty constitution of any human being on earth. So if there was someone who was going to have an adverse vaccine reaction to the new mRNA style vaccines, it would probably be Jen, and she got through it without even like mild flu-like symptoms or anything, which is the most common reported side effect. So and as for what I'm drinking, so we are an Arizona politics and drinking podcast, and just like we actually talk about national and international politics far more than we talk about Arizona politics. And unfortunately, this time I have another booze that is not from Arizona, but I have a special one for our next podcast that is from Arizona that I got on sale today that I'm going to save as a surprise because it's fucking awesome because the people at Four Peaks Brewery get me. They get me on a very deep level. So this is West Mall Trappist Ale. It's a Trappel. I decided I wanted something with a higher ABV that wasn't going to melt my goddamn face today like most IPAs do. So this is a 9.5 ABV. It is super smooth. It's not as sweet as that Green Mountain Trappel that we tried that I liked so much. But yeah, like the bitterness is turned way down on it. It's got a lot of nice, really warm flavors. It's delicious. This is good shit. And at Total Wine, it wasn't that bad for so 750 milliliters, and it was $11.
Not too shabby.
No.
Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, if you have the right way to find access to those COVID shots for those, you should put those up on the website, on our Facebook account.
I will. Yeah, actually, I need to ask Jen for the specific link, but I will get it up there, I promise, sometime in the next 24, 48 hours.
Perfect, because my mom is 73, and so she's still waiting on a shot, so I'd like to get her on all those lists. And I am drinking the White Russian Imperial Coffee Stout by Sun Up Brewing. It's delicious, I know, because I made it, and I love it. You guys should try it. Yeah. So White Russian from Sunup Brewing. I got a bunch of low fills because canning didn't go real well last Monday, but that's okay. because I got some low fills, and I'll drop a case off to you. Not you out there. I was looking at Dr. Sean Hayes. I was looking at Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD. Reggie, I do know your policy. You will trade low fills for barber work, so there is some coming your way as well. But yeah, what a tasty little local brew from 3rd Street in Camelback, Sun Up Brewing. If you're wondering, I think we've discussed on the show before, Uva, who is the who I'm learning how to brew from. If you're wondering what he looks like, all you have to do is look at the can, because that is exactly what Uva looks like. So yeah, there you go. We are actually, as Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, says, we usually cover national news. We're going to go ahead and start on the local tip today, because the state Senate, GOP-led state Senate, was trying to hold in contempt the Board of Supervisors from Maricopa County, because the Board of Supervisors of Maricopa County were doing their own audit of the voting machines. They had brought in two independent firms to perform the audit, and the state Senate got really upset about that, because they wanted to do an audit, and they wanted all the ballots to be turned over to them, and they wanted the machines to be turned over to them, and they wanted the firm that they chose, which just happened to be the same firm that Rudy Giuliani used in a whole lot of the Trump stopping the steal type stuff. They preferred to use that group. And so they were going to hold the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors in contempt and jail them over this until a vote that came down today, where luckily one of the GOP broke ranks and decided to give the Board of Supervisors a little more time. Basically, the Board of Supervisors are saying they are not going to do that unless a judge says, hey, you need to do that, because they are trying to protect our, as voters, information. And so they say that there's no reason. So anyway, Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, take it from there.
So in the state of Arizona, as in actually, I think it is all 50 states in the union at this point have some variation on this rule. However, whatever the lowest level organizing unit is for your elections. Actually, let's take one step back. So the United States Constitution says that determining the manner of conducting elections, that responsibility falls on state legislatures. State legislatures around the country have passed a variety of elections laws. There are very few that overlap significantly. Like, there's a lot of variation from state to state in the nature of the laws that they have governing their elections. One consistent law across all 50 states is that the lowest organizing unit, and that's usually the county, is responsible for conducting some sort of post-election audit automatically. Maricopa County, so Arizona is one of those states, and in Arizona County, the law states that the county board must conduct a hand recount of a certain percentage of the cast ballots, both the ballots that were cast on election day as well as early ballots. And then they must also conduct basically a logic and reliability test on the voting machine itself. Maricopa County went and did both of those things. They hired an independent firm to go out and do both of those things.
The
independent firm came back on every occasion and said, okay, the logic test was 100%. You know, the machines are counting the ballots accurately. We have optical scan ballots here in the state of Arizona. We don't punch them in on a touch screen. We fill out a paper ballot. That paper ballot is fed into an optical scanner. That optical scanner tabulates the votes, aggregates them based on polling station, then transmits them to, I think, a district level. The district level goes up to the county. The county certifies the vote and sends it to the state. So they tested those optical scanners. And they did a hand recount of, I think, like 5% of the cast ballots, both the ballots cast on election day and the ballots that were sent in early. The people who chose the ballots, Mark, were party representatives from the Democratic and Republican Party, equal, and they both got to choose an even number of ballots. Right. So Maricopa County didn't go out and select, like, it was a special batch of ballots, and we're just going to count these ones over and over and over again and pretend that everything's normal. Right. No, the representatives from the two parties were the ones who picked the ballots. They were also the ones who got to conduct the hand recount. Right. They actually sat there and helped with physically doing the hand recount. So this was a process where both parties were intimately involved the entire time, and it is a process that is dictated by state law. The other thing state law says is that the remaining ballots that are not sampled for this audit are to be locked away for no less than 24 months. They're to be locked away and kept secure. And the only thing that can get them out is a court order unsealing the ballots. And so the legislature, which is the body that wrote and passed these laws, turned to the Maricopa County Board of Electors and went, or Board of Supervisors, and went, we want you to ignore those laws and just hand over the ballots to us. Not just the ballots and the machines, right? They wanted the vote counting machines.
Correct.
The Board of Supervisors quite rightly said, A, there's no law that says that we have to hand you the machines, and that's stupid, so we're not going to do it. And B, the law very specifically says we can't give you the ballots. Not we don't want to, not it's going to take time. We cannot. You have to go to court and get a judge to unseal the ballots. That's what the legislature doesn't want to do, because they know if they go in front of a judge, the judge is going to go, what grounds do you have for unsealing the ballots? Like, you have to have a compelling reason to violate the sanctity of the secret ballot, right? So one of the core principles of our democracy is we have a secret ballot. We have that ballot so that you can't be pressured ahead of time to vote a certain way, right? No one can be standing over your shoulder and going, okay, now vote for that guy. Now vote for that guy. Now vote for that. Even if you want that person there, they can't be there unless you have an ADA exemption. And you can't be punished after the fact, right? The ballots can't be handed over to some party boss, right? Some QAnon nutbag who's hanging out at the state Senate, who goes through and starts handing out, you know, punishments to people who voted the wrong way. So the secret ballot is very important to our democracy. It's why many states, including the state of Arizona, which is one of the more libertarian states in the union, has a law that specifically says the ballots post-election must be kept in a secure, locked facility and cannot be disturbed by anyone for at least 24 months unless there is a court order unsealing those secret ballots.
If you were wondering what the difference is between a sealed ballot and an open vote, if we have time, we may get to the House of Representatives and the difference between a sealed vote for Representative Cheney versus a open vote for Miss Nutbag Green. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the difference in those votes, whether people are seeing what you're doing or not, it makes a difference in a democracy.
You were curious about the arrest thing. Even had that one person not broken ranks, first of all, the law only states that the sergeant at arms of the Senate can go and arrest the person and force them to appear in front of the Senate. It does not say that they can be jailed indefinitely until they do what the Senate wants them to do. It only allows them to issue a subpoena for testimony, and then the sergeant at arms can go and arrest that person and bring them in. The other option that they have is for the department, for the attorney general to choose to prosecute for defying a state congressional subpoena, which is a class 2 misdemeanor, which is a fine. No one was ever going to be arrested. No one will be arrested. And the whole reason why they're not going to go down that route, Mark, is because they don't want to go to court in the first place. Right. That's I don't know if it was this part may have been cut off earlier when we had our technical issue, but the whole reason the state Senate is being this heavy handed with the Board of Supervisors, because because Arizona law says that the way you get those ballots is by going to court and getting a court to unseal them. The state Senate knows no court in the country is going to unseal those ballots for them because they do not have a compelling reason.
But now, impeachment 2.0.
Impeachment redux. Donald Trump was only the third president in history to be impeached by the House of Representatives. And he is now also the fourth president in history to be impeached by the House of Representatives. He holds the dubious honor of being the first to ever be impeached twice in a single term, no less. Not even impeached twice over the course of two terms. You think he could at least he'd spread it out a little bit, like pace yourself, Donald.
I mean, he snuck the last one in right at the fucking end, you know.
Well, yeah, and
he was crossing the line.
That's part of what's causing some interesting issue, or rather, it's providing cover to a bunch of cowardly GOP senators who are trying to come up with any logic they can to dismiss the impeachment without actually having to vote to acquit Donald Trump, because they know, as do, you know, at this point, based on most of the public polling data, as does 70% of the country, that he's guilty as fuck.
No, but technicalities, bro.
Yeah, but technicalities. So let's start with those technicalities.
It does really seem like the party that was very hang 'em high and not really caring too much about technicalities getting those bad guys off seems to switch over a little bit.
They've always fucking been that way, though, man. They haven't switched over. Think about it. Go back to the 80s, which was the heyday of get tough on crime, right? It was the crack epidemic was just starting to hit the streets. And fucking every politician was making their name by passing as many mandatory sentencing guidelines as they possibly could. The feds were ratcheting up their mandatory sentencing guidelines to the point where you could get life for an amount of crack cocaine that wouldn't get you a slap on the wrist if you were a white guy carrying equal weight of powder cocaine, right? So like the 80s was a tough time for get tough on crime, but the second a bunch of Republicans get caught selling weapons illegally so that they can then they can fund other clandestine operations in other parts of the world, suddenly no one knows anything. We all need to find unity. There needs to be forgiveness. This is the divisive language, by the way. This isn't the first time we've heard it. We heard it when they were getting ready to try Oliver North back in the 80s as well, right? So like this has always been the shtick with the GQP, right? Like they only found their spines to walk Nixon out the door when it became clear that there was just no other option, right? He had been caught so thoroughly at that point that they couldn't wash their hands of it anymore. They fucking tried. It took forever to get accountability for Watergate.
Yeah.
Fuck those guys. They've always been this kind of hypocritical bullshit, right? Like, they, you know, contrasts abound, right? Like Hillary Clinton, it's lock her up, hold 8 years worth of hearings over the four people who were tragically killed in Benghazi, make her testify in front of Congress for 11 straight fucking hours, right? We're hang her fucking high, but Donald Trump and a bunch of his accomplices in the GQP fucking foment insurrection. Five people are dead right here on American soil. Suddenly it's divisive. We need unity. This isn't how the country moves on. Yeah, it's not a new song from these bags of shit. So let's talk about technicalities, right? Because the lawyers for Donald Trump, and it's interesting to note, by the way, that his initial batch of impeachment lawyers, the ones who handled the first Trump impeachment, took a look at this shit sandwich and went, fuck you. You can choke that turd down on your own, and bailed. So he went out and got anyone he could get, really.
Got Mike Pence.
Yeah. One is he's basically a con law crusader who's taken on, you know, he represented the Klan when the Klan was suing to be able to march with their hoods on and not have to pay the same public event fee that other event organizers would have to pay. David Schoen, that's the guy. So he's represented a bunch of different clients. None of them, he's never covered himself in glory as a lawyer, and he's clearly someone who lacks sort of a consistent moral compass and ethics. The other guy,
Bruce Castor,
there's the one. If that name sounds at all familiar to you,
It's because Bruce was originally involved in the prosecution of Bill Cosby. After it first started to break publicly that Bill had a disturbing habit of slipping roofies into the drinks of young women and then raping them while they're unconscious. And Mr. Castor, Esquire, is the district attorney from Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, who cut the original deal with Cosby and then promised him, made a handshake deal with him, promising him he would never go, he wouldn't be prosecuted and go to prison for what he did. Now, handshake deals mean, you know, two bits and a bucket of piss when you actually get to court. A judge is going to, oh, you had a handshake deal? All right. Good for you. And threw that shit right out, and now Cosby's in prison. So, you know, good for the judge in doing so, and good for Hannibal Buress in creating the original public outcry that sort of that originally drove accountability for Cosby. Otherwise, he never would have went to prison. And this Castor guy is one of the main reasons why he never would have seen a jail cell if it wasn't for Hannibal Buress. So, and a bunch of other people who worked very tirelessly to keep this in the head. I don't want to make it sound like he did it all on his own. That's not fair. So these two people are not only amoral bags of shit, but they're also terrible lawyers, as evidenced by the defense they've tried to mount.
How is the constitutionality of this?
The Constitution says that the Senate shall, not may, not can decide to, not eventually, not only under certain circumstances, the Senate shall try any federal official impeached by the House. Donald Trump was impeached by the House while he was still president of the United States. The Constitution is quite clear that now the Senate shall try him. Right. So the constitutionality question is, it's bonkers. It's nuts. It makes no sense. There is no reading of the Constitution that can reasonably support that argument. And there is precedent. The Senate has already tried one federal official after they left office. There was a Secretary of the Navy, I want to say Brockton, Brockade, something like that. Anyway, back in the 19th century, he was convicted or he was impeached by the House. He then left office and the Senate still tried him anyway. And as a part of that trial, had a vote on the constitutionality of the issue and voted 37-29 in favor of it being constitutional. So we have an established precedent already. We also disturbingly have a precedent of, you know, they voted 37-29. There were 29 senators even back then who were willing to look at the Constitution and somehow imagine that that argument was meritorious in some way. It's bizarre to me, Mark. You look at the plain language in the Constitution. And, you know, I'm not a textualist. I'm not an originalist. I think the Constitution is a living document. I think the supporting documentation from the time that it was written, particularly the Federalist Papers, established quite clearly that the framers of the Constitution, the people who actually wrote the fucking thing, intended for it to be a living document, just like the body of law that governs Great Britain, right? They don't have a constitution, but they have a collective body of jurisprudence, right? It's a living body of law. It evolves with the society. You know, the framers of the Constitution may not have been the greatest human beings on earth because many of them owned other human beings, but they were generally fairly smart people. I don't think any of them would have looked at a set of laws and gone, yep, 300 years from now, this will still be good. They won't be dealing with anything different in 300 years that we're than what we're dealing with right fucking now.
I don't know, man. Holds up.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm getting off track. So the constitutionality question, not only does the Constitution on its face clearly not only support but mandate that the Senate hold a trial at this point. There were, you know, a letter came out last week from 144 of the nation's preeminent constitutional scholars and lawyers, all of whom said that it is absolutely constitutional. And then today, one of the most prominent conservative lawyers published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that basically tore this constitutionality question to shreds, and did it in a way that should have left anyone who subscribed to this theory feeling deeply ashamed of their own stupidity. The reason why that op-ed is important, because it is there to provide cover for some senators who are likely to vote to impeach. And it's important to note that even though they held a vote, like Rand Paul staged his little stunt vote,
right,
to dismiss, there's no, by the way, there's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about dismissing, right? It says the Senate shall hold a fucking trial. It doesn't say anything about dismissing.
It was a weather vane. They just wanted to see.
So 45 Republican senators voted to dismiss. Now, a significant number of them, no one knows yet whether it's enough to get to 17. That's the magic number that's going to be needed in order for the Senate to actually convict this piece of shit. But a significant number of them have indicated, like, no, the whole thing was sort of rushed. We didn't really understand exactly what the procedural motion we were voting on was. We did not vote to acquit or clear him of charges or anything of the kind, right? So there is still a very distinct possibility that the Senate could vote to convict. The significant amount of energy that's going into providing public resources for those senators to defend themselves is remarkable on a bunch of different levels.
But is this going to be infringing on the president's First Amendment rights? I mean, he was just talking. There's nothing wrong with talking, right?
Actually, no, the Supreme Court disagrees. So there's an established body of law and precedent, judicial precedent, that indicates that there are no absolute rights. So, even the Second Amendment, which everyone seems to think is not everyone. Lots of people seem to think is goddamn universal. It's not. Even the Supreme Court has agreed that there are certain circumstances under which the Second Amendment can be restricted. For example, you're not allowed to bring guns into the Supreme Court. I don't think that the justices could muster a majority even on this court to allow guns in. There are exceptions. One of the most famous exception everyone cites, right, sort of the incitement clause, right? You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Now, there's an exception to that exception. When can you yell fire in a crowded theater?
When there's a fire in a crowded theater?
Yeah, when the motherfucker's on fire, you can yell fire in a crowded theater. But if you're in a crowded theater and it is not on fire and a reasonable human being would not believe that it was on fire at that moment. If you then yell that it is on fire to intentionally create a panic, that is not protected speech. You knew what you were saying was a lie and you were lying for a specific reason, right? That's not that the Supreme Court has indicated that that is not protected speech. So that's why this argument is coming up. The exception to that exception to the exception, right? And this is the way the law works. There's exceptions to everything. And you eventually winnow your way down to the very smallest exception, the atomic level exception, and then you can accept no further. The exception to that exception to the exception is if there's no fire, but let's say, it's opening night and the production company for the film decided to get a little creative and they had a couple of fog machines in the theater and you have somebody in there and they're, maybe they're a little jumpy or whatever. Maybe they're whatever the case may be. They see this smoke start to come up and they genuinely believe the theater is on fire. They then start to yell fire. People panic. They rush out of the theater. Someone becomes injured. It ends up in front of a court. Under those circumstances, if the person can reasonably demonstrate that there was a reason for them to yell, to authentically believe that there was a fire, then even though there was no fire, their yelling fire is protected speech at that point. That's what his lawyers are trying to say now, is that there's no way to establish whether or not his claims about the election were indeed true. If that's the case, you cannot establish that he didn't know they were true. So you cannot establish an intent to incite through the use of
false claims, blah, blah, blah. Basically, you can't place yourself in the exception to the First Amendment. You know, the no yelling fire in a crowded theater if there is no fire. Because they, you know, they're trying to make the argument that he genuinely believed there was a fire. And so he yelled fire. And even though there was a terrible result from that, his intentions were pure because he legitimately believed what he was saying.
I believe that there might be some argument for that he actually does think he actually believes what he's saying. But I guess since you said the word, we can get into the intent of it. Which, yeah. I watched parts of the speech and he did say peacefully one time in the speech. He said peacefully.
You're very rarely going to find a circumstance under which the Supreme Court is going to take several hours worth of speech, focus on a single utterance and go, the rest of it doesn't matter. Right. So the same way as if, let's say it had been, because it wasn't just Donald Trump, by the way, he spoke for 90 minutes, but before him, his kid spoke, Rudy spoke, a couple other people spoke. They were out there for fucking hours. Right. And over the course, so let's say the converse had happened, the inverse had happened, that for hours it had been a kumbaya love fest. Like, we are all super tragically sad that this horrible thing was done, and we need to make sure that it never happens again. We need to organize, elect people who believe the way that we do, pass electoral reform, make sure that this can never possibly happen to anyone else because, oh my God, it's so sad. And then one time, Donald Trump said something slightly incendiary, right? You gotta fight. You gotta fight like hell or you're not gonna have a country anymore. Right. So when it comes time to elect the right kind of people, you got to fight or you're not going to have a country anymore. Like, the Supreme Court's not going to let anyone focus in on that. You have to fight like hell or you're not going to have a country anymore. If it is placed in the context of 4 or 5 hours of peaceful kumbaya speeches. The inverse of that also holds true. The fact that he said peacefully 3 times over the course of an hour and a half speech.
I believe once, actually.
Oh, all right. Even better. Once.
I believe. I really do believe. I do believe he said peacefully once and like fight like 17 times or something. I'm pretty sure about the once. I don't know about the 17.
On his way out the door, a lawyer told him, "Hey, you have to say peacefully." Right, and so he managed to find a way to shoehorn it in there. Exactly the kind of idiot he is. The Supreme Court's also not going to hold with an argument based on the inverse of that, right? You have several hours of speeches, Rudy Giuliani calling for a trial by combat, Don Jr. using even more incendiary language than that, Trump himself driving home over and over and over again the dire stakes of failure, the need to fight and be strong and show strength and be vicious. And then he threw the word peacefully in there. And, well, that makes everything all better. No, it doesn't. That's nonsense. So, look, none of this stuff is in question, right? They're trying to make it seem like it's in question, but it's not. And this is essentially the game that lawyers play, right? You have a standard of evidence that you have to meet. In this case, the standard of evidence for the impeachment trial is very low. It's not the same as in a criminal trial where it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. For those of you who don't understand that, that's, you know, if you take the exemplar reasonable person of average intellect who is reasonable in their predispositions, they would look at all the evidence and find thusly, right? That's what a reason. And so if you are able to exceed that standard of evidence, then the jury should vote to convict. This is nowhere even close to that. This is somewhere around preponderance of the evidence. So most of the evidence tends to indicate that this person is guilty. You should vote to convict. So Trump's lawyers are playing to that lower standard of evidence as if somehow it redounds to their favor, which is weird because really it redounds to the favor of the House impeachment managers, right? It sets a lower bar for them, but they're treating it as sort of, you know, it's a looser affair in terms of its need to be faithful to truth and evidence. And so all they're trying to do is provide a bare minimum argument
that will allow senators to vote to convict while still condemning Trump's behavior. Right. So you'll notice all of their arguments are based around technicalities, right? They're not saying that it didn't happen. They're not saying people aren't dead. They're not even saying it isn't wrong to have done the things that they did. They're just trying to provide a bare minimum argument to allow senators to vote to acquit based on, you know, the sort of the most technical interpretation of the rules.
When I was much younger, I made a right-hand turn when I shouldn't have, and I very lightly hit a woman on a bicycle, and I got a ticket for hitting a pedestrian, and I went and I fought that ticket because I didn't hit a pedestrian. I hit a person on a bicycle, and that's not a pedestrian. And I got out of the ticket. Yeah. So, like, don't worry, she got paid by insurance and all that kind of stuff. But did I 100% hit her. I just didn't get a ticket for it because it was written up wrong. That's the kind of thing that they're trying to get away with. And I would dare say are going to. But here's a question for you.
I don't know if it's that certain, to be honest.
I know. That was going to be the thing. Do you think that there is anything that can happen in the trial in the Senate that would actually sway vote? Do you think that anything that could happen as far as public opinion seeing the trial that would put pressure to change votes? Like, is there any way that, I mean, because I'm kind of looking at it now and it seems that the procedural vote that it's, you know, it looks like five Republicans may jump on board. It's kind of the five that you, I don't know who they are, but I'm assuming Romney, Murkowski,
Collins,
yeah.
Sass, Ben Sass from Nebraska.
So,
and then there's one other. Yeah.
It's pretty few and far between, but do you think that there could be enough pressure put on to make them actually fucking do their jobs?
Yes. So the easiest way to do that would be to put Donald Trump on the stand, which is exactly why his lawyers already said not a chance in hell.
He is a walking fucking lie. And yeah. If they put him under oath, that they'll ask him what he had for breakfast. And he's going to say, I had a very light breakfast. I had yogurt with granola on top. You're going to jail now because we saw those fucking 8 egg McMuffins that you fucking put down.
Fuck. Yeah. So, and by the way, I guarantee you he's fucking desperate to testify. He's convinced that if he could get up in front of the Senate, he could win his freedom.
Going into, I think that he believes, like, it's so much easier to lie if you don't think that it's a lie.
See, but here's the thing. There were a bunch of people, occasionally myself included, who started to think maybe he really does believe this shit. Maybe he really is this fucking nuts. But no, it's an act, man. He's fucking with your head. And this is, like, this is, so, you know what, and I thank sort of Twitter at large for this. The best way to think about the relationship between Donald Trump and the United States right now is the relationship between a woman and an abusive man. Right? This is classic abuser behavior to destabilize reality, to destabilize truth, right? To destabilize sources of authority that aren't the abuser themselves. I think he is much less competent than a lot of people give him credit for, which is why most of his schemes ultimately ended up failing. But he is far less ingenuous than some people give him credit for. He is intentionally misleading. He's just not very good at it.
I will go slightly a different direction in that I think that he has just been the very best ever at fake it till you make it. Because if you like listening to that call to the official from Georgia, whose position
I never Raffensperger, the Secretary of State of the great state of Georgia,
like the shit that he was spouting out, like it sounded like he fucking believes his own bullshit. Well, have you looked into this and have you looked into these things? Like it's Trump sounded like he believes it though.
See, I listened.
I know he got rid of his SAG card. So I know he's no longer a member of SAG, so I don't know if he could be acting.
Oh, that was so great. Yeah, another scheme, by the way. He had no real desire to get rid of his SAG card. He probably hadn't thought about his SAG membership in a couple of decades. But it was an opportunity to get attention because he can't get on Twitter.
Well, he had to get rid of it because he was getting very upset. He wanted to make sure he got rid of it before they took him out of Home Alone 2.
You can't fire me. I quit. To be honest, I don't really think he does. Like, I think there are certain things that he is clearly delusional about, things that are sort of core to his identity. Like, I think he really does believe he's a good businessman, you know, that he believes like he's a savvy negotiator. Otherwise, like, if you don't genuinely believe that, you don't walk into negotiations with Kim Jong-un, right? Like, you send other people to go do that for you, unless you legitimately believe you're the best negotiator on earth. On the other hand, we have considerable evidence that most of the things that he professes sort of a profound conviction about are complete bullshit, and he's manufactured them to try and create a certain result. And again, this goes to his competence, right? The result very rarely turns out the way that he's hoping for, as evidenced by the great state of Georgia that announced today their attorney general is opening an investigation into Donald Trump for attempting to subvert their election, in part based on that call. Like holy fucking... He had four different lawyers on that call with him. Did not a single one of them bother to check the laws about recording a phone call in the state of Georgia?
And you know what? I think that might be a nice little bow to say that's the quality of lawyers that are handling his impeachment trial. Yeah. And now we can go into the ever fucking fun subject of COVID-19. And the relief package and all of that stuff. Speaking of Collins, Murkowski, and Romney and all of them, Biden has put forth a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. Of course, the GOP thinks that's too much because they only want to spend that kind of money on tax rebates for the ultra rich. They are working on that. But I mean, I would love to get some GOP members on board. I kind of think that we might need to push this through no matter what, get on board or be left behind. But let's go. Come on.
So first of all, the saddest part about this whole debacle is that you have 10 senators who claim to be sort of centrist, reasonable, get stuff done, can do. We're going to cooperate with the new president. Mitt Romney is the most notable exemplar in that group.
Come on, Collins and Murkowski, give it to them too. Come on, man.
I'd like to give it to them. All right, I give it to them too. They are just as guilty of this as Romney. They are playing old school gotcha politics in the era of insurrection. Right. So not only are they not actually cooperating in good faith, but they're not even playing the new level of political game, right? The new level is you deny all reality, mobilize your troops to commit acts of terror to eventually impose your will, right? That's the new level that we're at. They're still playing old school gotcha politics. That's all that $600 billion package was, right? They walked into his office knowing there wasn't a chance in hell that they ever got a single Democratic vote for that package. The stuff that they cut out to get that package down to $608 billion are the things that the Democrats have said over and over again are red lines. They will not move on without them. And that, I don't even want to, we can come back to the absolutely tragic way that Republicans have framed this argument about aid to the states, to state and local governments that are all hurting right now because of the state and sales tax crunch that's taken place as a result of COVID-19 and the additional money that they've had to lay out to fight COVID-19, right? That's where a lot of this money is being spent, by the way. It's being spent at the county and local level, state, county, and local level. Anyway, the fact that the GOP, the GQP has framed that as like, basically it's political favoritism to them. They don't want to hand out aid to state and local governments because there's no way they can target it only to their Republican friends. And they've come right out and said it. That's what they don't want to give bailouts to irresponsible blue state governments really means. It means we only agree with the way our friends on the right wing govern. So we only want to give tax dollars to them. And if we have to give tax dollars to states where Democrats live, then we're going to blow the whole thing up. It's fucking disgusting. It's despicable. They should be ashamed of themselves, but that deserves an episode in and of itself. The $608 billion was bullshit. It was dead on arrival, but two ideas came out of it that required our old friends AOC and her friends in the progressive wing of the House and Bernie Sanders on the budget committee in the Senate to resist. Those two ideas were, one, stripping out the $15 minimum wage requirement from the package, even though that would actually be a particularly effective way to try and mitigate the effects of this economic downturn that's taken place as a result of COVID. The other thing that they wanted to do was reduce the amount of stimulus payout. Right. So for those of you who have forgotten, a couple of months ago, a lot of people in the United States got checks for $600. Or if you're a family like ours, I think we ended up getting $1,700. So $600 each for Jenny and I, and then $500 for Phoenix, I think. Now, if you'll remember, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and the Democrats in general during the Georgia runoff races ran on the promise of, we will get you the rest of that money. We agree that $2,000 is what's needed. We'll get you the rest.
Right. There's a semantics in that one that I guess we can get to or not, whether a $2,000 check is the same as a $1,400 check to round up to $600. We'll get there. Or we don't even have to get there. Guess what? $2,000 is still $2,000, however you want to hash it out. And I understand the people on the Democrats, and I understand everybody, you said $2,000. I'm supposed to have another $2,000 check. Guess what? Better than nothing.
I've had a lot of arguments with those people over the last couple of weeks because they are dead fucking wrong. No, never once did the Biden administration or the Democrats promise that it would be $2,000 in addition to the $600 we had already received. And it's just it's petty and fucking dumb. And it's the same thing that Democrats always do to each other when they're in charge. We've always got to start slicing each other's nuts off. The second, you know, we actually managed to get our shit together long enough to win a fucking election. And it's always got to be about the stupidest stuff. Like, really, do you honestly believe this is the last stimulus package that you're going to fucking pass? Just shut the fuck up. Take the $1,400 and move on. But now where we're at is they raised enough hell squawking about 1400 versus 2000, blah, blah, blah. There's all sorts of uncertainty on the left now about who will vote for what. And the Republicans came at us with, no, $1,400 for everyone who got a $600 check is too much. And here's the thing that kills me is that Biden and Pelosi and some other leaders in the Democratic caucus, because we have a couple of turncoats, Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema, who I'm ashamed to say is from our state of Arizona, have indicated that now that they are essentially the moderate wing of the Senate, just the two of them, they're going to demand that everything be done their way. And they, for whatever reason, despite the fact, by the way, that $1,400 checks has wildly bipartisan support around the country, like in excess of 70% support from the voters that are voting for these two people. And in the case of Joe Manchin in West Virginia, his own goddamn governor, a Republican who is far to Manchin's right, by the way, came out and said, listen, you stupid son of a bitch, get it fucking done. The people of West Virginia, whether they make $100,000 a year, and that's combined for the entire household, or $150,000 a year combined for the entire household, they need that money. Get it to them yesterday, you idiot. Right? That's someone to the right of Joe Manchin telling him that from his own state. And still they're holding out on this. So in the House, they managed to actually get $15 minimum wage back in. And they're still... So
I, from the state of Arizona, who fucking voted for Kyrsten Sinema, worked to try and get her fucking elected, right? I've got people from New York and Massachusetts who are doing a better job of representing my interests than she is. So I'm not happy with Miss Sinema even a little fucking bit right now.
And that goes double for her bullshit claim that she would never support overturning the filibuster. Fuck her, man.
Let's talk about somebody that we do like. So let's talk about Bernie and his cute little jacket and his little mittens. And that'll be another that'll be the fourth podcast that we do, which will be the Why America Doesn't Deserve Bernie as President, which will be the Mark LaRue podcast. So Bernie, now in charge of the budget committee.
That's pretty right. Doggy.
Anyway, so let's discuss reconciliation, because I have another idea about reconciliation, something that I heard on Plastic Cup Politics podcast a few years ago. But through reconciliation, you can hammer shit through with 51 votes with Kamala Harris. Yes. Once again, gonna need to guide Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin along the way to make that a possibility. But what can be done through reconciliation?
So let's start with the fact that the filibuster doesn't exist in the Constitution.
Right.
It doesn't even exist in law.
We're discussing rules and norms, and I think that after the last 4 years. Fuck rules, fuck norms, I think, and fuck your feelings was the GOP's way of doing things.
Exactly. Okay. So this is a rule that the Senate adopted shortly after the Civil War, and it was adopted to explicitly to help slave states, former slave states, fight against reform. So it essentially was, it was designed to give an outsized amount of power, to smaller states that wanted to ensure that the victorious Union couldn't, unilaterally impose upon them the conditions of defeat, which is in the very goddamn nature of being defeated. You lost a fucking war. You started a war. You fucked around and found out, right? And now you want to, the whole thing just makes me crazy. So the filibuster is a rule. It was a rule that was adopted to help former slave states. It's a rule that has been instrumental in preventing the overturning of Jim Crow laws and other odious laws over the course of the last 150 years since the Civil War. It is a pathetic and antiquated and outdated instrument, and it should have been done away with a long time ago. Starting about 10 years ago, because during the Obama administration, the Republican Party was blocking consideration of all Obama judicial nominees and some of his cabinet nominees. The Democratic majority in the Congress or in the Senate said, all right, we're done with that. So there's still a legislative filibuster, for cabinet nominees. It's now just a part. It's 50 votes plus one.
And the Democrats put through also judicial nominees.
Nope. That was
excluding the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. It was judicial nominees excluding the Supreme Court. And then in 2017, the GOP put through, they further eroded the rule, basically saying that even Supreme Court nominees, it's just now a part, it's a 50 plus one vote. You don't need a filibuster.
Which, kind of makes sense. You're saying, hey, all judges should be able to vote. Oh, wait, not those, other than these nine guys.
Yeah.
But you can, everybody else. So, yeah. And so, by the way, if we're going to start talking about this, that's what I don't want to have happen again, is the Democrats put some shit up and then have it rammed up our fucking asses.
Well, there are two ways to deal with this issue, and I'm starting to despair of the Democrats doing either of them, but Chuck Schumer has started to give me a tiny bit of hope. We'll see. He's showing a tiny bit more spine than he did than he has in the past. So there are two ways to deal with this. The filibuster is a parliamentary maneuver, right? So in order to vote on a bill, you first have to close debate. And most of the time, debate is closed via unanimous consent. It's possible for one party to object to closing debate, and then a vote is required. In the Senate, the rule was adopted long, long ago that in order to close, to force the closure of debate and then move on to a vote, you have to have a supermajority, 60 votes plus one. Right? Or, 66 votes plus one. So a total of 67 votes in order to close debate. And so and by the way, the reason you needed those 67 votes is because in order to actually filibuster, and for anyone who's into old movies and has watched Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you would know that the way a filibuster is supposed to work is that if you want to filibuster a bill, you got to get up there and goddamn do it. You have to man the podium around the clock. Read from the phone book, read from the legislative record, read from whatever the fuck you want, but you cannot stop. You have to stay up there.
Strom Thurmond style.
Yeah. And then the Senate can vote. And if they vote, you know, if you can get 67 votes to close debate, they can cut you off and move on to the vote, whether you like it or not. If they can't, you get to keep talking, but you have to keep talking.
So during Strom Thurmond's, I believe it was a 24-hour filibuster against civil rights, you're thinking, man, how did that guy go that long without eating or going to the bathroom or anything like that? When you're driving around Scottsdale, think about that question as you're driving down Goldwater Boulevard, because Barry Goldwater held his water for him, and while he had to go do stuff, Barry Goldwater would come up and start talking until Strom Thurmond came back. So enjoy that when you're by Fashion Square.
For all those people who want to try and resurrect Barry Goldwater's image as somehow being indicative of sort of moderation and reasonable governance.
You have to get your 67 votes. At some point in the last few decades, the something that is now informally referred to as the shadow filibuster developed. And that is basically the threat of a filibuster. So if you go to the other side and go, you don't have 67 votes. And the other side goes, yeah, we don't have 67 votes. All right, fuck it. We'll move on. We're not going to vote. They don't make them filibuster. They just accept, all right, we don't have the 67 votes. It can't pass. So what basically happened then was the Senate has become an institution where in order to pass legislation, which is the last thing remaining that the filibuster applies to, you have to guarantee you have 67 votes to pass any bill. That's unworkable. There's a reason why Congress hasn't gotten anything done in the last 20 years, regardless of whether they have split, divided government or one party has control of all three the House, the Senate and the executive branch, which is only two branches of government, not three, contrary to Tommy Tuberville. So there's a reason why Congress hasn't gotten shit done, and that reason is the fucking filibuster. Because if you have to have 67 votes to pass everything, the only thing you're going to be able to pass are like declarations that it's some sweet old lady's grandma's birthday, and that's a special holiday, and shouldn't we all feel good about that? That's the kind of shit you can get 67 votes for in the fucking Senate. Nothing else. So that's what we're stuck with now.
But can we dodge...
We can.
That argument.
Through budget reconciliation.
There we go.
So at some point over the course of the last few decades, some folks in the Senate went, this is stupid. We can't keep doing this. People vote for us. They spend a couple $100,000 a year paying our salary, millions more than that guaranteeing our safety and comfort. We can't keep coming here and not passing legislation. This is not going to work. But the only thing they could get all sides to agree on that it was okay to bypass the filibuster about was budget-related items. That's the only thing that both Democrats and Republicans could agree. All right, yes, we can absolutely bypass the filibuster for this. So there's a set of arcane rules about what qualifies for budget reconciliation. But basically, it has to have a direct and material impact on the budget of the federal government of the United States. And there's a couple of other qualifiers. I can't remember what they are off the top of my head, but if you meet those qualifications, you can then be passed via the budget reconciliation, you being a bill, right, a hypothetical bill, can then be passed via the budget reconciliation process, which only requires 50 plus one votes, so an actual majority as opposed to a supermajority. It's how, by the way, the 2017 tax cut that blew a $2 trillion hole in the budget was passed, was via budget reconciliation.
Ig fucking exactly.
Yeah.
So this is my brilliant idea that I have had since we've been on this podcast, because I remember talking back when the 2017 bill was passed, about now that's $1.5 trillion that has been approved in a budget.
Yep.
So now with control of the presidency, the House and the Senate, you can reconcile that budget as well. So how's this for an idea? You go to the Republicans, those 10 Republicans that are saying, hey, you want the money for COVID vaccine stuff? All the things they say that we haven't touched in the Biden plan? You want those things? We want to give you the money for that? You go, I appreciate that. We love it. Let's do it. Let's do that today. Boom. There's $897 billion done. And then you take the other trillion out of that tax cut through reconciliation.
Yeah, so here's the problem with that is tax cuts are generally popular.
Oh, well, I believe that Bernie is in charge of that now. I think that maybe Bernie might be able to trim that $1 trillion out of some places that might be popular.
So I agree with you. And by the way, I think that sort of the zeitgeist, public opinion about this is shifting as well. Right. That 2017 tax cut has become ever more unpopular over the course of the last few years, and it is now near its nadir in terms of popularity. The American people have really started, and the American people, right, for a very long time, and it's been something that people have spilled thousands of gallons of ink writing about in newspapers and books. Right, is the proclivity of the American people to fall prey to the delusion that they will be the next one to join the billionaire class.
100%.
And so if I'm going to be the next one into the billionaire class, I don't want a bunch of onerous taxes passed on that, because then it's going to be taxing me.
Of course.
And if I'm going to be the next one, I don't want those taxes there, right? So even though those taxes not only don't apply to me, but they mean that the things that I need that legitimately only the federal government has the resources to provide, I'm not going to get, because that money is going back into the pocket of billionaires around the country. That's okay by me, because I'm going to be the next billionaire. Now, of course, we all know that's not true. Like, you and I are both very smart dudes, and we're fairly creative. We're good at doing a lot of things. We're never going to be billionaires. Like, unless there's hyperinflation, right? And what's in my bank account right now eventually becomes $1 billion.
I don't even play the lottery.
Yeah. We're never going to be billionaires. It's not going to happen. But there are so many of our countrymen who, whether they will express it explicitly out loud or not, legitimately believe that they're going to be the next one. That's starting to change.
Some rapper just put a $24 million diamond in the middle of his forehead.
Well, fuck that guy. What a... And you know what? Fuck all the people who covered that story as if it was something new. You and I know the first person to do this kind of extreme body modification. He's a guy from Arizona. We all knew him. He was in the punk rock scene. Joe, whatever the fuck his name was. He was the first guy to have spikes implanted in his goddamn scalp. Right? He did it over at HTC right in Tempe. It's been going on for almost 40 fucking years now, and these people are acting like it's the first goddamn time it's happened.
With a $24 million diamond.
Well, yeah. So he's the one who did it the most expensively. Whatever. Woohoo. Good for
him. How you end up in the... I mean, like, it's not just the first guy in the Guinness Book of World Records. It's the biggest guy in the Guinness Book of World Records. Anyway. I really am kind of enjoying my reconciliation idea. I like it a lot. You show your bipartisanship. You get the vote through. And then you just go, oh, these things you guys forgot. We'll clean those up for you. No big deal.
I'm starting to get to the point where that could reasonably happen. Right. The reason why it doesn't happen automatically, Mark, and why it wasn't like priority number one on day one of sort of democratic control of the levers of power in Washington is because there is still, unlike the GOP, which has no moderate wing left at all anymore, there's right wing and then further right wing and then QAnon. Those are the grades of GQP at this point. And grades one and two in the GQP are sympathetic to the QAnon wing. In the Democratic Party, we still have moderates, as evidenced by fucking Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, pieces of shit. And you lose all of them if you immediately start slashing money from those tax cuts. That conversation has to, by the way, that doesn't mean it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Again, that's another thing that Joe Manchin's friend, who's the governor of West Virginia, said, right? Like tax increases don't need to be off the table either. At this point, you either go big or we all go in the ground. And that's where we're at. There's no more fucking around at this point. We have reached the kind of epochal crisis that shatters empires, right? It's a confluence of political crisis, health crisis, and economic crisis all at the exact same fucking time. That's the shit that breaks empires that span centuries, that were around much longer than the United States has ever been around. So we are still at this very moment, while we're recording this podcast, it feels like a lot of the danger has passed. We are still in a moment of tremendous danger for our republic and the people who live in it. You and I and all of our listeners. We have to be extremely careful about what we do next.
So I was going to go a different direction, but I think I'm going to pull this thing in with this. So I talked to Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, to make sure that he knew what the whole QAnon theory of what was going to happen on January 20th was. So let me just run this through real quick. And if I get it wrong, you can feel free to correct me on this. So the QAnon folks were very upset because clearly the election was stolen, because there's no way that they could have lost by that amount. Like, it just doesn't make sense that their candidate could have lost by that amount. So what they were hoping was going to happen was, when the new regime was going to take power, that they would call in martial law and bring in the military, and the military would come in and they would arrest all the people who committed this voter fraud, and Nancy Pelosi and Biden and Kamala Harris would go away in chains, and the real rightful government would go in and take their place.
So you're almost there, right? So think about what you just said and how crazy it sounds, right? You were almost crazy enough to be QAnon, but not quite. So what they were actually arguing wasn't necessarily voter fraud. Voter fraud was just a small part of it, right? So what QAnon has been arguing all along, and this actually, the antecedent to this, for those of you who remember, we actually talked about it on this podcast, was Pizzagate. And if you remember, there was a guy in D.C. who marched into Comet Ping Pong Pizza, which is a little pizza place off of, I think it's off of DuPont Circle. Northwest DC, not like a super famous pizza place, but John Podesta mentioned ordering pizza from there for his staffers at some point in the emails that were stolen by the Russians and then subsequently leaked prior to the 2016 election to try and help Donald Trump. Well, some crazy people read that as a secret admission that Comet Ping Pong Pizza was the location where the Democrats were secretly running their satanic pedophile sex ring. Let that sink in for a moment. It's as batshit crazy as that sounds, that is legitimately what they believe. So what QAnon legitimately believes is that there is a cabal of incredibly powerful Satanists. And those Satanists secretly run the world. And in addition to secretly running the world, they also run a system for abducting, sexually abusing, and then mutilating, cannibalizing, and murdering children.
Okay.
I'm not joking.
That's I know.
Legitimately what they believe.
So, oh, go right ahead.
So they, in addition to that, they believe that this is the part where, so believe it or not, the pedophile cannibal sex ring isn't even the part where you completely go over the edge. Right. So where you completely go over the edge is when you then believe that God himself sent Donald Trump to secretly fight this cabal of satanic pedophiles and their proxies in the deep state of the United States, the bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy of the United States. And that as a part of this plan, the plan that they refer to repeatedly in their little message boards, right? So just have faith in the plan. The plan involves at one point something that they refer to as the storm. Now, this is what they thought was going to happen on January 6th. The storm doesn't involve just the military coming in and arresting Nancy Pelosi.
We're talking about the 20th, correct?
First they thought it was going to happen on the 6th.
Okay.
And it's part of what some of their followers were doing, storming the Capitol. Right? They thought they were carrying out the plan, and they thought the military was going to show up to assist them in the plan. Right. And there are videos out there of some of them screaming at the police officers that they're supposed to turn around and help them go in and arrest members of Congress. Right.
We're so doing this for you. Yes.
Yeah. So the plan was that they would go in, the military would help them, they would arrest all of these satanic pedophiles, and they would erect a massive public gallows and hang all of them. Let that sink in for a little bit.
Yeah. I saw the gallows that were erected.
Yeah.
So you take that little, I think that what you're talking about is kind of the cult bouillabaisse, that the mirepoix that is added to everything. And then I will go back to my, there's no way we could have lost this election.
But that's because God sent Donald Trump here to fight the satanic pedophiles. That's the only reason we can't have lost the election, Mark.
Shush.
Oh, sorry. I apologize.
We'll get back to the no way we could have lost this election. So clearly it was rigged.
Yeah.
We cannot let the powers that cheated to win this election take power. So we need to bring in the military to take over, and we need to jail the people who stole the election and won by a huge vote. So we can go ahead and hold back all that crazy stuff. And Dr. Sean Hayes, can you tell me what has happened recently in a little place used to be called Burma and now is called Myanmar?
Yeah, so there was a coup. The democratic government of Myanmar / Burma is only about 5 years old. Before that, the president of that, I think they actually call themselves the Democratic Republic of Myanmar. I may be wrong about that. A woman named Aung San Suu Kyi spent 15 years on house arrest, or actually alternating between house arrest and actual imprisonment, by the military government of Burma / Myanmar. That military government had been in place for 6 decades. So it was one of the longest running military dictatorships in the world. They eventually agreed after, a lot of sort of pressure and protests and international pressure to start transitioning to democracy. And they did so. And the party that Aung San Suu Kyi represents won a significant portion. Like they didn't just squeak by. They won a very convincing
margin.
Yeah. And the military wasn't very happy about that, but they decided to roll with it, to honor their word. But there were certain tripwires in the agreement that they had made with Aung San Suu Kyi and her party in terms of power sharing, one of which was, 25% of the seats in the country's legislative body were explicitly reserved for the military's party. In the most recent election, Aung San Suu Kyi's party won far more, won a percentage of the parliament that would have meant that the military, that their proxy party would not have gotten its 25%. There were a few other things that the two sides have fought over recently, but the election was sort of the end of it. There's a bit of bad luck involved here too, or not bad luck, but just timing. It's coincidental timing. So the guy who currently leads Myanmar's military is going to retire at the end of this year. And when he retires, he basically becomes like, he'll be an incredibly wealthy private citizen, but he'll just be a private citizen. And once you have tasted the life of supreme leader, you don't want to give it up. Right. So in addition to this spat with Aung San Suu Kyi's party over the 25% carve out in the parliament, there's the fact that he's about to be out of a job. So they sent in the tanks and the armored cars, and they seized Aung San Suu Kyi and the leadership of her party and placed them all in chains and have taken back over. So, and they cited widespread electoral fraud, by the way, as their reason for mounting their coup.
So it almost sounds like what you're saying is in Myanmar after an election that the military thought that they didn't win, or that they thought that they won, the military came in and started martial law and went in and jailed the people who were dutifully elected. Even if she is a fucking horrible fucking racist, which she is a horrible fucking racist, but we're not talking about that. All I'm trying to say is, you know what QAnon wants? Myanmar. That is what they were that was their end goal, right? They want us to be like Myanmar. Is that what it kind of sounded like to me?
Yeah. You know what? It's even closer than that. So there's the people who legitimately believing in QAnon, right? The cultists. But then there's a much larger group of people who are just sore losers. Right? They've had power, sort of unmitigated power, for the last 4 or 5 years, and they don't want to give it up. And they're using any excuse they can to circumvent the law so that they don't have to give it up. And that means aligning themselves with these QAnon people. The sad part is, or the saddest part about this is that what those people don't seem to understand is that what comes next in Myanmar, and anyone who's familiar with the history of transitions between democratic to autocratic regimes, in particularly in Southeast Asia, what comes next is thousands of people disappear.
Which, from what I can tell, isn't exactly against the QAnon theory of what should happen.
Yeah. These are the people that Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley are telling you you should seek unity with.
Right.
Yeah.
So I do believe that that is where we're going to end this podcast. But I think we need to do a couple quick hitters after this. Little one subject ones, because I am very fascinated by the whole Robin Hood what is the digicoin thing, all that kind of stuff. I'm super interested in that. Yeah, so totally. I would love to hear what you have to say about that. And if you want to hear about what Dr. Sean Hayes PhD has to say about that, you should go ahead and click the subscribe button however the hell you're listening to this. If you have any questions for him about that or anything else, or if you want to ask me about beer stuff, I don't know, you can do so at Plastic Cup Pod and all your favorite social media sites. We're old, we don't really fuck with Twitter, and there's really not much of pictures because we're both ugly. So Instagram, you can still put, you can still message us on Instagram. Maybe we'll see it, but Facebook's the best place because that's where old people hang out. And thank you all very much. And like I said, subscribing is the best way to figure it out because we do these things when we fucking want to.
Exactly. And for those of you who want some really interesting reading material that actually, if you're curious about what the new center might look like in 5 to 10 years, I mean, ideologically and politically, take a look at the Lincoln Project.
If any of them had the fucking balls to do it while they were still there, hooray for Jeff Flake and your fucking moderate views. Like,
well, keep it. So Jeff Flake isn't actually affiliated with the Lincoln Project, though. So, but I agree with you. I really wish Jeff Flake had had more of the courage of his convictions while he was still a United States. Maybe not even retire. Maybe go down swinging.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. I'm 100% on your side with that. Like Mitt Romney pretending he's now a profiling courage, right? And still he comes at Joe Biden with this $608 billion offer as if it's a serious offer while we're in the middle of a fucking crisis. He's playing goddamn centrist politics. Fuck this guy. So yeah, I'm 100% on your side, but most of the people involved with the Lincoln Project are not actually politicians. They're people who were formerly involved in Republican Party politics, who have now left the party and sort of formed their own group that was in many ways instrumental in defeating Donald Trump in the 2020 election.
And they have, yeah, they have some really, really good production people. Like, they have some really, really good minds. Like, the content yeah, they're putting out is top notch.
And I still disagree with them on a ton of shit because I'm a liberal Democrat. I'm not ashamed of that in any way, shape, or form. And I don't think anyone else should be. I think for decades now, we've been made to feel ashamed of declaring ourselves to be liberal Democrats. Well, fuck that and fuck them. So I still disagree with the people in the Lincoln Project about a lot of things on policy.
Right. No,
but I love my goddamn country, and so do they. And that's
right. And that's what I was going to say. Like, oh, it's going to be so much more of a fun fight going against Lincoln Project rather than fucking QAnon. Like, oh, finally a battle of wits.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm down. I'm in. I'm ready for that battle just as soon as we can kill this cult.
All right. We'll see if we can get more wits on the next podcast. See you guys.
Later, everybody. Whoa!